Today is April 25th, 1994. This is Margaret Van Cleve. I will be interviewing Catherine Fenton, who came to Fairbanks in 1940, and with her husband, Mac Fenton, later established their own drugstore in downtown Fairbanks. This tape is made possible by a grant from Igloo No. 4 Foundation, Pioneers of Alaska. We are recording in the library at Pioneer Home in Fairbanks. So you came to Fairbanks just before World War II, when the town was fairly small, about 3,000 people, and travel involved a fairly long boat trip from Seattle. What do you remember about that particular trip? We can start with Seattle and...
Well, I took McKinley, which was one of the old Alaska steamships, from Seattle, and we came up the inside passage most of the way, stopped at a lot of the villages along the way. They had freight to unload. And I came into Valdez. And at that time, there was a road from Valdez to Fairbanks. And I didn't want to take the extra days that it would have taken to go to Seward and then up on the railroad, because I could get into Fairbanks 2 or 3 days sooner by coming through Valdez. And there was a bus running from Valdez to Fairbanks at that time. And my husband had sent me a ticket for the bus driver to pick me up, but he didn't find me. And there were a couple of station wagons coming up that planned on driving right straight through. At least one of them was going to drive right through. And that would put me in Fairbanks a full day ahead of the other one, several days ahead of what I could have made it on the train. And when I told him I didn't have money enough for the fare, he said, well, that was all right. As long as my husband was working in town, that I could pay him after I got to town. So I came in COD.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Do you remember what boat, bus that you came on? That was in the area that you were supposed to take.
Well, I think at that time Billy Root was running the bus line, but he never did find me. We got the ticket back after he got to town, but they were 2 days, I believe, on the way.
Mm-hmm. So how many hours were you on the road, do you think?
Well, we left the boat fairly early in the day, and we traveled all that the rest of the day. We stopped at Tonsina to eat, and they had prepared a meal for us. And then we went on up, but they were having trouble with water in the gas, and the car just kept dying, and they would wait for the other station wagon to catch up, trying to figure out what was causing the trouble. And they didn't have any filters for the gas or anything. But it was slow going, and every time they'd get to a little incline, they'd get water in the carburetor again, and it would die. And it took quite a little while. Actually, by the time we got to Rapids Roadhouse, the driver was quite exhausted, and he decided that he would stay there the night. Mm-hmm. And they had taken part of the passengers on the other station wagon when we started having car trouble. But there were, as I remember, there were 3 or 4 of us left on that particular station wagon that I went in on. And they stopped overnight there. And Sue Revelle was running Rapids Roadhouse at that time. And I wasn't going to go to bed because I didn't have money enough to pay for a room. And she said, oh, that was all right. I could send her the money when I got up here.
Do you remember what the room board or room and board was for that?
No, yeah. I don't. I remember.
Other than you just didn't have the money.
I just didn't have that much money because I'd had to buy a meal at Tonsina, and I hadn't expected if we were going to drive right straight through I probably had $4 or $5, but not enough to pay for two meals, which would have been what it would have been because we'd have had the dinner at night, and we didn't get in till after midnight.
It was a long day.
Well, it had been a long day and a very hectic day, bad for the drivers. They were exhausted because they had to stop and drain the carburetor every time they got water in it. And it was, and then they waited for the other car because apparently the fellow that owned the station wagons was traveling in the other car. And as it got more hectic, then they started switching the passengers around.
And there was no road service to help you out.
Well,
you
were lucky to be able to buy gas, and they pumped the gas out of barrels. And of course, I think that the barrels had probably been sitting there all winter, and that was probably why there was water in them.
Yeah, what was the road like? Was it gravel road?
Oh, yes, it was gravel. There was no surface road. And it was not bad. I had been raised in mountain country, and I had traveled over some rather rugged roads, so it didn't bother me at all. There were some of the passengers, an elderly gentleman, that complained bitterly about the road and about the driving and everything else until the driver finally just stopped and asked him if he wanted to get out.
Walk instead.
That was just as we went up over the hill outside the Valdez.
Oh,
right up there.
Thompson Pass.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess
he
that was...
He offered to let him out at Thompson Pass, and the man decided that he didn't want to complain anymore.
That was the end of the complaint.
Yeah.
Do you remember some of the people you traveled with?
Well, Gladys Morris was on the same station wagon that I was on, and there was a young fellow from Dartmouth that had come up on the boat with me. He was coming up to go to work up here, he thought. And Mary Berglund was in the other station wagon.
So that was a fairly common way to get to at that time of year.
If you could get through, the buses weren't bad, but they weren't terribly comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And it was easier. You didn't have so many people concerned when you wanted to stop. You could stop where you wanted to.
So you arrived in Fairbanks. Just about the longest day of the year, I see, a few days afterwards.
Yes, it was just a little while afterwards.
Bright and sunny at 12 o'clock midnight.
Yeah, it was a beautiful night.
So what were your first impressions of Fairbanks? Was it what you expected? Because your husband had come up here a few weeks ahead.
Yes, he had been here for over a month when I got here. And it was terribly dirty. The streets had not been surfaced at all. And that near the breakup, there was about 6 inches of loose dirt on the road. The only bit of concrete in town was from First Avenue to through Second. And it was terribly dirty. I remember the store windows looking dusty. But I enjoyed the daylight, and I was glad to be back with my husband.
What was housing like? Did you have a place, or I guess he had a place already? he ready for you.
He had rented an apartment up above the Silver Dollar Bar.
Where was that located in terms of...
It was on 2nd Avenue, and it was about three buildings down from Blanchfield Alley. I don't know whether you know where Blanchfield Alley is.
Yes, I do. And it is just that, a little alley.
But there was several bars along that street.
So I imagine it was pretty lively at night.
Yes, it was, and rather noisy.
So you either slept with earplugs or just got used to the noise?
No, you just learned to turn it out.
So your husband was a pharmacist and came up to work for another firm at that time.
He went to work for that store that was called McIntosh and Cuban, but it was actually owned by John Clapp and Mr. Cuban at that time.
Mm-hmm. And I know it had several locations. Where was it?
It was always on First and
Cushman.
Cushman.
Where the present day Key Bank is now.
Yes. Yes. Mr. McIntosh had a store down in Old China. And when they moved the town up to its present location, he moved the drugstore up there.
And then he became partners with Cuban a little bit later.
I don't know.
But at that time,
when they went into partnership together.
So when your husband came, it was just Mr. Cuban?
Mr. Cuban was, Mr. McIntosh at that time was dead. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Cuban was running the store pretty much, he and Mr. Clapp.
Did you look for work right away when you came, or did you wait a while?
No, I didn't. They were building Ladd Field. And they were still hiring out there. And I went out and was accepted, but in the meantime, I heard that my mother was very ill. And I started thinking about going back to take care of her because we'd been in Seattle for over a year when my husband decided to come to Alaska to work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you weren't originally from Seattle, you just...
No.
...come there as sort of the...
Well,
interim.
I had gone to high school in Seattle. I went to Seattle with a sister and brother-in-law and their family, and I finished my high schooling there.
Mm-hmm. So where was your home originally?
In Utah, southern Utah.
Mm-hmm. So did you, you say you considered going out to take care of your mother. Did you leave at that point, or did the war break out in the meantime?
No.
So we're still talking 1940.
That's right. I went out in the fall of that year. We had decided to move into out of the apartment because it was terribly noisy and not the type of conversation I was used to.
Not your usual neighborhood.
And we rented a cabin over in Grail, on Front Street in Grail. And then there was quite a buildup of armed forces and soldiers and everything, getting the base ready. And with my mother ill, I decided that I would go out and do what I could to take care of her. And I did. I went out, and I was in the States when Pearl Harbor was hit.
Yeah, in December. Yeah, the following year. Was it difficult getting back to Alaska?
Yes, it was really a challenge.
So what was it like getting back the second time?
Well, it was right after Pearl Harbor, and the country was very excited and very much in doubt as to how extensive the damages were, only what we got on the news and where it was going to go from there. And I was most anxious to get back to Alaska, and so I called right away and made my reservations, and was fortunate in the fact that people were still so upset they didn't know what they were going to be doing. And I got on one of the early flights that was a two-plane flight. The one flew from Seattle to Juneau, and then we traded planes there, and I flew the Lodestar back to Alaska. We stopped overnight at White Horse. We got in White Horse Christmas Eve, and I'll never forget what the desk clerk said. He said, "My sympathies are with the traveler on Christmas time." Anyway, it was a small plane, and we did get in Christmas morning, and Joe Coble was at the airport and recognized me and took me to the cabin where my husband and I were staying.
So at that time, the planes routinely went into Canada before coming to Alaska?
Well, they were not capable of the long flights that they were later. They had to stop and refuel along the way, and they went into any port that they could that was open where they could get fuel. And it was before the treaty with Canada ran out. Later on, the treaty that was between the United States and Canada, that they could land or take off during any of the hours, ran out. And then you could only land and take off from a foreign country during the daylight hours, and that made the flying later on much more difficult. And I was involved in one of those flights too, and held over in White Horse for a week.
I was going to say, in the winter time, your daylight hours would be very limited.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It was quite difficult to find if the plane would be in and be able to take off during those daylight hours. But the first flight, I remember, they told me, and I asked how much luggage I could take. They said that I would be allowed 15 pounds of luggage. And I had bought my husband a shotgun that was to his own specifications, and that was 9 pounds of my 15 pounds of luggage that I brought back to him.
I say people certainly travel with a lot heavier loads today.
Well, I did other times too, but...
What effect did World War II have on the town? There was a lot more military people. What about housing? Was there quite a shortage?
There just wasn't that much housing that had bathrooms and running water around. If you wanted to rent a cabin with outside plumbing, it wasn't so hard to get. But even then, most everyone bought their water by the jug.
Mm-hmm. One of the local watermen.
Yes, uh-huh. They delivered it. You hung a sign in the window how many bottles of water you wanted or how much, and then they would bring it in.
So very few people, I guess, at that time had their own water supply.
There weren't very many.
It was all
people who had built their own homes, of course, did. But as far as rentals were concerned,
it was all.
You were lucky to get an apartment that had a bath and running water. And even then, sometimes the water wasn't what you'd call really desirable.
Do you know where the water came from?
Yes.
From a local, I guess there was a big well downtown?
No. No, almost everybody had their own wells. There was a little water that the NC had around the downtown area. There was pipes that went to several of the buildings and the bars and the hotels.
We get that water.
Where it was available.
So I was wondering where the waterman got his.
He had his own well, and it was clear water. And that's why people bought it, because the water that you got out of the pipes downtown was orange.
Color of tea.
Well, not even.
Not even that palatable.
It was had definite dye ability. You could put a load of sheets in there and they'd come out a nice bright orange.
So no such thing as white towels in those days.
No.
Well, describe some of the other features of life in Fairbanks at that time. I guess it was pretty easy to meet your neighbors because you relied on one another so much.
You got acquainted with people just simply by proximity. And people would do anything for you, but they never infringed on you. It was up to you to prove yourself worthy of the
friendship.
They were always very nice, but they never would bother you. You could do whatever you felt like, and I sort of had the feeling that they just sat back and watched you to see what kind of a person that you were.
Sized you up. You were talking earlier about what the town did about undesirable people.
Well, if they had been in trouble a lot, they just sent them outside, sent them on a what they called a blue ticket. And then they paid their way out, and they were not supposed to come back.
So this would be they meaning the city government or just a group of citizens or?
I don't really know who arranged it.
But it worked.
It worked. It worked very well.
So,
and since there was limited transportation in and out of the territory, it controlled it very well.
So you really didn't have to worry about people coming in the wintertime.
No.
It's summertime, I guess.
The only way they could come up during the winter was on the train or if they could fly in.
Mm-hmm. You had to have money for that, so you didn't have any freeloaders at that time of year anyway.
Well, and there wasn't the employment in the winter that there was in the summer. The mines were working in the summer, and there was quite a bit of employment that way. But in the winter, only jobs were in the downtown area or someone that was a caretaker for one of the mines or something like that.
So did some of the people leave for the winter, or do you think?
Oh, there were a lot of people that could afford it that would go outside during the winter.
Mm-hmm. They were engaged in mining and really had no reason to stay.
Whatever they did, they felt that they needed change.
So it was probably a very different type of life in the winter.
Yes,
very
it was.
Very quiet, and I guess no auto traffic.
Very little auto traffic. The stores all had delivery wagons. They delivered practically all the groceries in town were delivered. You either took your order in or phoned it into the grocery store, and they filled it and delivered it to your home.
This would be NC Company or
NC and Piggly Wiggly. Laveries, and Piggly Wiggly.
So they're all pretty much in the core of downtown at that
time. Right.
So most people lived within a mile or so of.
Oh, they
or even
there,
less than that.
Were very few houses that were beyond a mile from town.
So you managed pretty well without transportation.
Oh, you could walk any place in town and
just everything
nothing.
You needed was right there.
Well, when you figured that 10th and Cushman was almost out of town at that time.
It's hard to believe.
And mm-hmm. and you had 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th avenues that were pretty well built up with houses.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you later worked for the telephone service. Was that a little bit later in the war, or was that after the war?
No, it was about right in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm. And that would have been at the NC Company? Or?
Yes, the NC Company owned the telephone system. Mm-hmm. They owned the water system and the steam system. And mm-hmm. they furnished steam to a lot of the downtown buildings with the steam line. Mm-hmm.
So the precursor of MUS. Describe what it was like working as a, I guess, switchboard operator, where you had the long cords that you'd plug into the wall.
That's right.
Was that called keyboard? The board that you plug into.
Well, it was a manual board. It was operated by hand. There were four different exchanges, theoretically, because the lines were set up so that every telephone line, that there were four parties on it. And the keys were set up so that you could ring into any one of these parties.
How many?
There was 700 jacks on that board. So you 4 times 7 is 2,800 was the most phones that they could
accommodate.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Did two people work at a time, or?
There were usually three or four. There were four positions on the board.
Mm-hmm. Did you work with Clara Rust? I think she was a
No, I worked with Cora Weir and Ann Kreitz and Rosie Boyle when I first went to work there. Mm-hmm. And Eva Collins also worked there. I think that they had about 8 operators at that time.
So that would have to, just about cover the clock.
Well, it did. They had 24-hour telephone service, but one operator handled the traffic alone after midnight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when the calls would theoretically be very low.
Well, sometimes it was a very busy time.
What shift did you usually work?
Well, I just worked where they told me. I worked relief in the summer when the woman who had been the night operator for a long time, when she took her vacation, and I worked one of the positions on the board most of the rest of the time. Mm-hmm. But it just depended on who had time off and whether I was needed.
Did you find you knew just about everybody in town after working as
you memorized the numbers and the names so that you knew who you were talking to. When the light would come on the board, mm-hmm. you knew within 4 positions where that call was coming from.
How long would the numbers be? Because I know now we have 7.
Well, there was what they called East. That was one of the exchanges, and Harvard, and then there were 2 other exchanges.
Mm-hmm. So a phone number might be Harvard 233.
456, or?
So a combination of 3 numbers with the exchange.
Usually, the position on the board of your key indicated which exchange you were ringing in on.
Mm-hmm.
And then you plugged into that particular number.
When the board, or when it lit up?
Well, yeah. Not when you were ringing. Mm-hmm. If you went into a light when the board lit up, and then you would pick up the call off of that particular number, mm-hmm. and where that call came from was dependent on where they were calling from, which exchange they were calling from. And to call back into that number, you had to know which exchange.
They really kept you on your toes.
Well, you knew the people, and you knew what mm-hmm. their telephone number was, and mm-hmm. so you got to know pretty much where everybody in town was.
Mm-hmm. I guess you got a lot of the emergency calls.
Care of all of the doctor's emergency calls mm-hmm. and the fire calls.
Would that be a special number then? Like 911 today?
Yes, there was the doctors had home phones, and the fire alarm was 5-1. And if you plugged into that number, you set off a fire alarm all downtown. So you had to be
really
a little
sure.
careful about that if you wanted to call to report a fire that wasn't a major conflagration. Mm-hmm. You called the fire chief or the fire department and let them know why you were calling there. It wasn't a fire alarm. But if you plugged into that one number, you turned on the fire alarm.
For the whole town.
That's right.
Well, I guess there were occasions where it seemed like the whole town was burning.
Yes, there were some bad fires.
Yeah, a couple of bad ones in 1946.
That's right. Well, there were some bad fires before then.
That.
But there were three really bad fires the year after we opened the drugstore.
Yeah, it was...
The co-op burned and that area along
on
there.
On 2nd Avenue.
On 2nd Avenue.
That would have been... Was that the 1946?
Yeah. But before that, there had been the Smith's Gun Store burned. And there was all kinds of ammunition in there.
Oh.
And that made for quite a bit of excitement.
I bet. It sounded like the 4th of July going off.
But, yeah. And Wachter's Meat Market was right along by Smith's Gun Store.
I guess it was sort of a domino effect with so many of the buildings still wooden that one would start and it would just
It was
go.
Very difficult to contain them, and that was why a fire alarm was almost a call for help all over the community.
Yeah, I guess a lot of them would serve as volunteer firemen?
Well, they went to do what they
could. What they could, yeah, mm-hmm. just unofficially, but it was...
Well, lots of times it required moving merchandise or saving what you could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've had a few bad fires since, but yeah. fortunately not like in the early days.
Well, it was pretty rough because mm-hmm. the... with no city water system to amount to anything. They had to pump a good deal of water. When they could lay hose to the river, then they could pump out of the river.
River. Mm-hmm. But in the winter
time. But in the winter, you couldn't do that.
So what would they do? Just have
They
some
had pumper trucks.
That would carry just
they
a
carried
limited amount.
Quite a bit of water.
So if they ran out, then... You're in trouble.
That's right.
Couldn't
That's
right. turn on the faucet and get more.
They had to go to the river and pump more water into them.
So even in the wintertime, I guess they broke through the ice to get into the river?
I imagine that's what they did. I don't know. I never actually watched them, but I do know that they laid hose from the river out because it was, you had to be very careful and not drive over one of the fire hoses.
Oh, the big canvas hoses that they used to use, yeah. Yeah. See, well, during the war, of course, you were still working at the telephone exchange, and your husband continued to work at Cuban drugstore.
Well, he worked for, they closed the Cuban drugstore. Mr. Cuban sold to another druggist here in town. And he wasn't able to run it himself. And it was during the war, it was quite a little bit later that my husband went to work for Mr. Dunham in the Red Cross drugstore. Mm-hmm. And he worked for him during a good deal of the war. They couldn't ever decide whether they wanted him in the army or whether they wanted him as a pharmacist or just exactly where they wanted him. So in fact, we went outside twice because they had told him to report for induction, and then they didn't want him. And it wasn't because of his health or anything else. They just figured that he was more useful
as a pharmacist. So he would have seen a lot of the military personnel in town.
Well, he did. He did quite a lot. He, they had machine guns that they had shipped up after Pearl Harbor, and they didn't have any mounts for them. And while he was still working at Cuban's, there was a fellow who was a blacksmith out at the base, and he knew that my husband had had some training in the university where he went, what would be comparable to the ROTC.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And he had a machine gunner's medal. And the blacksmith came to him and asked him to help him design, tell him how to make a mount for these machine guns, because they never knew whether we were going to be fighting in the streets there.
Yes, there was a real fear throughout the war.
Well, there was very little defense in this country.
You just really felt vulnerable.
Well, they had gone into Pearl Harbor, where we had some of the best defenses of any place in the country, and just made a mash of it. Mm-hmm. And they could have, had they had manpower, they could have come in and they could have taken all of Alaska.
Of course, Ladd Field was up and running by that time and was
Was running very inadequately. What good are machine guns if you can't use them? Anyway, they designed a machine gun mount, and someone told me not too long ago that they still had some of those old mounts.
Oh, for goodness sakes. So he got Ladd Field well prepared with machine gun mounts.
No, it was not. It was never well prepared. I think that was one of the things that was the most frightening, is that they didn't realize how vulnerable they were. Hmm. We had a few planes, and I have heard that one of the things that saved this country was that when the Japs flew over it, they saw a number of planes that had been sidelined to one of these fields that was down on the coast, and there were four or five planes that had been sent in there because they didn't have an optional field that they could land on. And they thought that the whole of Alaska was armed and had that many planes. So it was a mistake on their part too.
Oh, this is when they were Dutch Harbor, and
yes,
or bombed Dutch Harbor, and of course got into the Aleutians.
And then they were in Kiska and that too. Mm-hmm.
long ways away, but still, it was Alaska. And
that's right. And the weather was such that we didn't have the forecasting of weather that we have now, and you got your weather right in from the Aleutians. You would hear about a storm coming up this way, and that's how you knew what the weather was going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not like our modern satellites today.
No, no. Yeah. And there were, of course, people our age, there were a lot of them in the war, and there were a lot of them that were flying for the war effort. And it was pretty shaky.
Yeah, and I guess you had blackouts in town, too. I learned that and talking to other people.
Yes, it was good and black.
It certainly is in the wintertime. that must have been pretty gloomy to walk down the street and not see any light.
Well, you just sort of wandered around. There weren't many of the businesses that weren't blacked out completely.
So they would put tar paper or some heavy material on the windows?
There were blackout curtains, and they were pretty strict about it.
Hmm. So people would there be a warden that would go around and check to make sure everybody was compliant?
Well, I don't know. I imagine that the police officer checked, but a lot of the men in business downtown walked guard duty on the buildings that they considered of major importance to the town. They had men carrying their own rifles that walked guard duty at the FE company and
probably NC company.
That's right.
Strategic.